It's Tuesday, February 15, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Well, this much is now clear. What happens in Egypt won't stay in Egypt. There are uprisings in the streets of various Arab capitals, including Algeria and even in Iran. And all around the Arab world and in the Islamic world, there is now an uprising against the kind of autocratic government that had been until recently represented by Egyptian strongman President Hosni Mubarak. Now, several things are really interesting here. The New York Times on Monday morning broke a story that there was an unknown and undetected link between the young people who led these revolutions in both Tunisia and Egypt. For instance, here is an email that was sent from a Tunisian young person to his friends in Egypt, quote, "Advice to the youth of Egypt, put vinegar or onion under your scarf for tear gas," end quote. What you had going on here was more than just a coincidence of historical parallel. What you had here was, first of all, in Tunisia and then in Egypt, the uprising of youth who were looking for jobs, tired of political repression, and determined to make a difference. Now, it is fascinating to see what went on in the aftermath, and this is so often the case. In the aftermath of this kind of historical development, you're able to know more about what was going on at the time. You know, and by the way, these days, given the velocity of the press and the speed of the net, we know these things much more quickly than we knew them in the past. For instance, to do an autopsy on something just like the 13 days of the Cuban Missile Crisis, it took decades. But now, given the way the web works and the way information is more and more free, we know a great deal more, and we know it more quickly. For instance, here's something we know. President Hosni Mubarak pretty much knew within the last couple of days of his reign that the gig was up. He pretty much knew that he had lost the confidence of the military, and yet he held on to power. Why? Well, David Kirkpatrick and David Sanger, writing at the New York Times, have corroborated what's been reported elsewhere in the international press, and that is that Hosni Mubarak was basically encouraged to stay in office against all costs by his son Gamal, who also, until recent days, had been thought to be the logical successor to Hosni Mubarak. Of course, what ended was not just the reign of Hosni Mubarak and his presidency, but the Mubarak regime. Now, here is something else for us to consider, and especially as Christians look at this picture. We are reminded that God himself rules in the nations. We are reminded that the rising and the falling of empires is not just a matter of historical circumstance and happenstance. It is a part of an unfolding story of, for instance, a cause and effect of sin and righteousness, of the outworking of human travail and human hopes, and also, of course, of the sovereignty of God. Well, here is something to consider. We often think of today's context as the singular context of rapid social and historical change. Well, we just tend to look at things such as the almost instantaneous, it seemed, collapse of what had been an indomitable Soviet empire in the years from 1988 to 1990. But consider that this is not the first era of this kind of rapid social change, especially when it comes to governmental systems that were common one day and virtually rare, if not non-existent, the next. I'll give you the classic example. The classic example of this is the collapse of Western monarchies in the aftermath of World War I. If you go back to the years before World War I, approximately 90% of the population of the earth was under a system of government that was basically, undeniably, monarchical. It was a hereditary monarchy, especially when you look at Europe. You just looked at the Austro-Hungarian Empire with the Habsburgs on the throne, and then you look at the reunited Russia and with the Tsar, of course, and the Romanov dynasty on the throne, and then you look at a newly resurgent Germany with Wilhelm II on the throne, and then, of course, the entirety of the British Empire with the newly renamed House of Windsor on the throne. Well, at the end of World War I, with the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the fall of Wilhelmine Germany, and of course the revolution that brought the Soviets to power and toppled the Romanovs in Russia, approximately 40% of the Earth's population went from being under a monarchy one moment to being under something very, very different the next. And when you saw, for instance, just one monarchical family, and that is the fact that approximately Well, something just over a bare majority or plurality of the world's peoples in the year 1910 were ruled over by some relative of Queen Victoria of Great Britain. Then you go to the end of World War One, and you say, well, just in a span of a few short, incredibly bloody and horrific years, the world was literally changed. Now, I raise this because right now the most nervous people in the world are probably those who are fellow autocrats in the Arab and in the Muslim worlds. They are the ones who right now have targets on them, or at least some kind of historical ticking of a clock that makes it very difficult to imagine how they continue in office with plausibility after you've seen these remarkable revolutions in Tunisia and in Egypt. It'll be fascinating to see what happens here. But one thing's for certain, there are a lot of very nervous heads of state throughout the Arab world. Speaking of the Israelis, it seems that the Israeli government has come to terms with the fact that the Egyptian army is intending to maintain the Egypt-Israeli peace treaty, and that's a good thing. As I heard from one Israeli diplomat earlier today, we worry for a living. And I understand if you were in Israel and had that responsibility, you probably would worry for a living. I had the privilege of being on a phone call with an Egyptian leader this morning, and I was reminded of something that it's good for an American to hear. Well, we were all expressing the hope that there would be a speedy consolidation of a good and representative government in Egypt. Well, this Egyptian said, let me ask you a question. When was your revolution? 1776. When was your constitution ratified? 1781. There was about a 5-year period there when the United States was developing its own system of government that we know now. It's easy for us now to forget that there was a period of some political foment between our revolution and the constitutional order of a republican, that is, an elected republic that we know now. So it is very interesting to see that, of course, as many are hoping and praying for the best there in Egypt, and that means not only, of course, from a Christian perspective, a representative government with political liberty, but also an opening for the gospel. One last word about Egypt, something else that is becoming clear in recent days, is that there was not unanimity among the Christians in Egypt as to how to respond to this revolution. It turns out that the Coptic Christians, Egyptian and North African group of Christians, basically had enjoyed the political coverage offered by Hosni Mubarak, and they opposed the revolution. But evangelicals, well, they generally supported the revolution. And also, as they are more represented among the young, they shared many of the aspirations of the other young. And it'll be interesting to see as these young people now are watching this military government say that it will move in a speedy transition to a democracy, to see if their hopes are indeed realized. We must hope, of course, that they are. At my website at albertmuller.com, on yesterday, Valentine's Day, I posted an important article entitled Adultery Incorporated, the Infidelity Industry. Now, here's something that I found almost, well, unthinkably bizarre. It's Valentine's Week. How does Bloomberg Business Week mark the occasion? With a cover story on the infidelity industry. It centers on a man by the name of Noel Bitterman, who is a Toronto businessman who wants to sell you an adulterous affair. The Bloomberg Business Week cover story included his statement, "Monogamy, in my opinion, is a failed experiment." Well, he's doing a great deal of business trying to sell affairs. He started a website known as Ashley Madison, identified as the premier dating website for aspiring adulterers. He said he came up with the idea after serving as an agent for professional athletes. So many of them were having adulterous affairs that he thought there ought to be some way to make money by facilitating it. Now, Ashley Madison and its parent company grow $60 million in revenue, produce $20 million a year in annual profits. Bitterman himself is making millions of dollars a year, and adultery appears to be a growth industry. Now, there's a lot behind this, and if you go to my website, you'll find the article published yesterday entitled Adultery Incorporated, the Infidelity Industry. I think you'll be shocked to know just how out in front of an issue like this, with absolutely no embarrassment, this man is in presenting his case for Ashley Madison and for creating a website that basically makes possible the liaisons that lead to adultery. There's one other point here, actually two I want to mention. One is a matter of statistics. According to the statistics documented by this company, the metrics upon which they base their business, approximately 20 to 40% of heterosexual married men and 20 to 25% of heterosexual married women will have an affair during their lifetime. That's one thing to note. That's a heartbreaking statistic. One other thing to note is the kind of moral evasion that was stated by this man in terms of describing his business, but also by his wife. Now, just imagine this. Your husband becomes a multimillionaire by establishing a website in order to facilitate others committing adultery. You just read him or heard him to say that monogamy was a failed experiment. And you're his wife. Here's what she said. Really, the business itself doesn't match who he is as a person. It's not our lifestyle or value system or any of that, end quote. Well, my response to that is clear. Here's a clue. If you conceive, establish, and run the business, it is your value system. The motto of the company, life is short, have an affair. Adultery is, well, it's who you are as a person, even if you never have an actual affair, if you conceive of this business and sell it to facilitate the adultery of others. By the way, some are suggesting that Ashley Madison should be better conceived as something of a prostitution service, since 20% of the women who sign up for the site thus far are single. Another article I published yesterday at albertmuller.com you'll find in the Marked Urgent column. It's entitled, Is a Catholic College Really Catholic or Is Baylor Really Baptist? It has to do with Manhattan College in New York. The Archdiocese of New York listed as a Catholic college. It claims to be a Catholic institution. But the National Labor Relations Board recently ruled that the college is not a religious institution and thus is not exempt from national labor laws. Why? It's because, quote, the school's core purpose isn't religious enough to trigger a labor law exemption, end quote. Now, I found that fascinating. Not religious enough? Well, it turns out the Manhattan College does not require its faculty to profess Catholicism. As a matter of fact, it becomes unclear to see how the school functions as a Catholic institution at all. The National Labor Relations Board found that the college's, quote, stated purpose does not involve the propagation of religious faith. Teachers are not required to adhere to or to promote religious tenets, and a religious order does not exercise control over hiring, firing, or day-to-day operations, end quote. In other words, it appears that Manhattan College is basically a secular institution with a Catholic label. And even if the Catholics aren't complaining, well, along comes a government agency, in this case the National Labor Relations Board, to say, we're not going to give you a labor exemption if you're not actually Catholic. Now, here's another line that you'll find very interesting. As USA Today and Religion News Service were reporting on this, they made a statement that this is going to create problems for many institutions, particularly, let me read you the line. Religious colleges are being warned, observers say, to show their core purpose is to propagate religious faith or else be treated as a secular enterprise. That could pose a special problem for liberal religious organizations, which seldom require students and faculty to endorse specific creeds or doctrine, end quote. Well, I couldn't have said that better myself. By the way, that very same day, last Friday, came a news release from Texas indicating that Baylor University, that bills itself as the world's largest Baptist institution, is now going to allow at least 25% of its trustees to be non-Baptists. The spokesperson, in this case, the regent chairman speaking to this, said it was being done basically to relate to the demographics of Baylor. Let me read to you. It says here, for example, the composition of the freshman class is slightly less than one-third Baptist, and the majority, the overall student body, is non-Baptist. I just have to wonder how many Texas Baptists, who supposedly believe with great joy that Baylor is the world's largest Baptist institution, know that less than one-third of the freshman class is slightly Baptist. Well, just what is a Baptist institution? Well, it better be one that's actually, well, Baptist, that holds to Baptist beliefs and attracts Baptist students and hires Baptist teachers. Other than that, we're just like the Catholic college, where no one can figure out exactly why it's Catholic. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmuller.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.